Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. China, of course, under the Chinese Communist Party, is at the forefront of the war for the free world these days. Everyone in America knows it now as a result of their experiences of the pandemic unleashed by the Chinese Communist Party, hence preferring now to call it the CCP virus. A woman who knows a lot about the Chinese Communist Party is our first guest. She was a political prisoner for a time at its hands in China. She came to the United States and studied here, achieved a PhD from Harvard University, became the Voice of America's China branch chief, among other things. She helped found Radio Free Asia's Cantonese service. She is an author of Born American, A Chinese Woman's Dream of Liberty. She is also, these days, an independent filmmaker and a very, very valued guest, as well as a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Her name is Sasha Gong. Sasha, it's good to have you back. Welcome. You have spent much of your professional life in journalism and have experienced firsthand both the propaganda of the Chinese Communist Party, and you have worked to counter it through the information services of the United States government. I'm very interested, Sasha, in your thoughts about what China is up to at the moment in terms of the aggressive propaganda campaign it is mounting against the United States, specifically in connection with the provenance of the coronavirus, the CCP virus, as we think of it. They're claiming it's actually the United States Army that was responsible for introducing it into Wuhan. What do we make of that?
Well, you see, as a famous American politician once said, you never let a crisis go waste. This is the crisis China is using, is utilizing fully. What we see is that everybody in the world, even all the Chinese people, understood it originated from China. And now they actually sent a few test balloons. Some Chinese spokesman said this or that, and on social media, not even in the official press. Let's say America's military people brought it, and it spread like wildfire, and they are using that to test what kind of reaction America will have. And also they use it domestically to, you know, shift the burden, shift the blame to the United States. Some people believe it, as they know propaganda have its use. But America, I think our State Department and our president, the cabinet, had very strong reaction to deny that sort of semi-official rumor. And the Chinese in the past few days actually took it back. And the Chinese ambassador even went to American TV to take it back.
Well, and the president apparently has decided he's going to forego further use of the term Chinese virus, so perhaps there's a standoff on that score. But as an expatriate from communist China, let me ask you about another audience that is perhaps not as obvious to us for this Chinese propaganda campaign, and that is the people of China themselves. And I just wonder, as you reflect on these contentions that the United States has essentially waged biological warfare against China, might it be the case that this is being used by the Chinese Communist Party as a means of essentially preparing people of China, inflaming them against the United States, and setting the stage for some kind of conflict involving China and us or Taiwan or others, perhaps?
China has been doing that for years. And if you carefully look at what the propaganda record, not the Chinese official record, you know, they smile to America a lot in order to get their benefit trade and all. And but if you trace their propaganda inside China, what they do, how they talk about America, I would say in the past 10 years or even 15 years, the propaganda in China towards America is towards more and more hostile. And that's a very important trend American government hasn't been aware for some time until recently, until the Trump administration. So for that, and we pay a dear price for thinking China as our good friend or at least our little brother. And the Chinese are far more ambitious in this way. They need to mobilize their people, especially their young people, to prepare a war. Maybe not a hot war, I'm not that sure, but at least what we see now is quite warlike.
That's the concern that I have, and we'll be talking about it more with Gordon Chang and Chuck DeVore and David Goldman in the segments to come. But I do fear that there seems to be, accompanying this propaganda behavior, some warlike steps, or at least bellicose rhetoric and preparatory actions that should be very concerning to us as we look at the state of preparedness of the Chinese Communist Party and its military, the People's Liberation Army, to engage in hostilities. We'll watch this closely, as I know we'll use, Sasha. Let me just ask you before we have to let you go about one other aspect of your portfolio, and that is the efforts that the Chinese have long made to restrict the outside world from knowing what's going on inside China. That seems to have increased markedly of late with the expulsion of American journalists from Beijing and elsewhere in China. Talk a little bit about what the Chinese government is up to in that regard and its implications.
Well, officially, we only have two reporters, official reporters from Voice of America in China. China has hundreds. Their government, they even have a TV station with several channels with everything here. And we treated them as part of the media for a long time. And we also have private newspaper media like New York Times, Washington Post, they're in China. And China just expelled New York Times and Washington Post and several reporters. They are the best, Wall Street Journal. They are the best reporters in the China reporting field. So, and I think this, that I don't think the Chinese people have much of opportunity to read what these people said in the English-speaking world. But the Chinese government seems to be determined to not allow people outside China to understand what's happening in China. That's what they are always hiding. And what are they hiding? We are an open society. We open to any media. But they are not. And remember, all the reporters, all the newspapers have been in China since the 1970s, and now they are closing them up.
And that means that as a result, we are more dependent upon Chinese sources for information about what's going on, and that certainly serves the party's interests as well, does it not? Sasha Gong, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Much more to talk with you about. We're very anxiously awaiting some of the fruits of your work in the independent filmmaking business you're in at the moment. Thank you for joining us, as well as for being an important member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, which is trying very hard to help the American people understand what we're really facing. And your assistance in that regard is deeply appreciated. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Gordon Chang joins us next. We'll drill down a bit more on this problem the Chinese Communist Party represents for its own people as well as for us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang. One of the high points of our program is a chance to visit with one of the country's preeminent authorities on China and what it is up to. The Chinese Communist Party, most especially, what it means for all of us. Gordon is, of course, the author of three important books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea. You see him frequently at Fox and read him, I know, in the National Interest, the Daily Beast, and elsewhere. He is, of course, most easily followed at Twitter. Twitter, Gordon G. Chang. And, of course, you can follow him here, too, and we are very happy to do. Gordon, it's good to have you back with us. Welcome. You have been very much in evidence throughout this crisis involving what I think of as the Chinese Communist Party virus, the CCP virus. Gordon, talk a little bit about how things appear to be playing out for the party inside China itself at the moment in the wake of this pandemic.
Well, there's so many aspects to that, Frank. There has been, of course, criticism of the party's handling of the CCP virus, not only from China's people, which is a bit white-hot anger, but also from elite figures in Beijing. This can have one of two effects, including inside the party itself, from what we can tell. This could really have two very different outcomes, and we don't know which way it will go. One of them is that Xi Jinping could be weakened, could lose his job. He is, after all, generally considered to be responsible for one debacle after another, something that was evident last year and this year. So you talk about declining economy, the trade war, Hong Kong, and now the coronavirus. But this could paradoxically actually strengthen him. And the reason is that the Communist Party is so threatened that I think senior figures are starting to understand that it could actually lose power. And so Xi will be able to consolidate his position, basically because his argument will be, whether you think I caused these problems or not, we're all at risk and we're going to lose the party unless you rally behind me. So I think that there will be some tendency for him to try to use this to strengthen his position. Ultimately, I don't think that works, Frank, because party politics have become really rancid. But nonetheless, that's going on. To look at this Chinese society as a whole, and I think this is fascinating, China is portraying that there has been a recovery this month. And that's true. We've seen the number of cases subside from January, February period. Also, the economy seems to be picking up a little bit. But I think Chinese leaders understand that there is a second wave of infections coming. We can see this from the increase in the number of cases that Beijing is, in fact, reporting. Go back 2 weeks ago, they were reporting low single digits, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 new cases a day. Now they're reporting dozens. The last one was 67, day before that 47, day before that 78. They are saying that there are no community transmissions except for one of them in the last week. That's just not possible. So I think that they're headed to a second wave. I'm not sure the party is going to be able to survive another round of infections because people, I think, are just sick and fed up, and the problems in the economy are going to come back and hurt them.
This raises the question that I touched on with Sasha Gong in the previous segment, and that is China is obviously, under the Communist Party, now becoming more aggressive, shall we say, with its efforts to divert blame from the party to the United States, to the Italians, to basically anybody but the Chinese Communist Party itself. Given the backdrop that you've just described, the evident fear that the party may be losing its grip, and especially if there's a new uptick in the disease, what is your reading, Gordon, of the possibility that what the Chinese Communist Party is up to at the moment with its propaganda and for that matter, other steps that it's taking to sort of foster, the political scientists call it the term social engineering, foster a sense of external threats that demand the country rally around the party, around the nation, and perhaps set the stage for actual conflict?
That's a possibility, Frank. We're seeing, for instance, an increased tempo on the part of the Chinese military in the waters and airspace around Japan, but more important, Taiwan. You go back to, I think it's the 16th of this month, where the Chinese rammed a Chinese Coast Guard vessel, partially disabling it. Shots were fired, Taiwanese. And so there is... I think a hostile Chinese military that may feel it has more latitude to do what it wants. Going forward, the problem for Beijing, I think, is that as they try to create this foreign enemy, they are going to lose support in the places where they need it, especially the United States. And so their propaganda campaign from the foreign ministry and the Global Times against the U.S., especially accusing us of spreading the virus to Wuhan, actually accusing the U.S. Army of spreading the virus to Wuhan, I think is really going to trigger a fundamental reassessment of relations with Beijing. So ultimately, I don't think this works. But of course, the more insecure the party is, the more dangerous it becomes, the more it can take us by surprise. So we need to do a number of things, as Arthur Waldron says, to psychologically disrupt the Chinese leadership. And that very well may mean, for instance, withdrawing diplomats, expelling their diplomats, all sorts of things that we should be considering right now, because the Chinese regime is at one of these critical points. And that means we're at one of these critical points.
I think suggestions about how we can deter China and throw it off its game, as you say, the Chinese Communist Party are very much needed and ought to be part of what we're addressing as the national priorities in this country at the moment. Though we are hearing, as generally we do, from the pro-China camp in the American elite, that we need to engage with China further, that in the aftermath of this coronavirus, we need to cooperate with China. That's not just coming out of, you know, the propagandists in Beijing, even as they attack us, of course. That's also now part and parcel of what they are finding their, well, I call them useful idiots in this country, repeating like a mantra. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there will always be those people who advocate engagement, but I think that the strength of their voice is diminishing, largely because China is delegitimizing them. We're going to have a test of that tonight. There's going to be that virtual G20 meeting, and China is at right now gotten to, you know, the propaganda point of saying everyone in the world needs to cooperate with each other. I don't actually see the President of the United States and the Secretary of State actually wanting to cooperate with China. So I don't think it's going to happen. Now, I think we can be better at coalition building than we have been over the past weeks. But nonetheless, I don't see very much happening from the G20. And given all of that, because Beijing has been pushing us away, I think that essentially the American people have now understood that we really need to move as far and as fast as possible away from China. You know, we used to think that, oh, you know, the problems that communist China caused were sort of located in China itself or Hong Kong or Taiwan. But with this disease, we can see that the failures of the Chinese regime, its weaknesses, have now crippled our society, because our economy and our society is very much at a standpoint because of the virus that came from China.
It definitely has awakened in a lot of people skepticism about China. I think there's no question about that. And President Trump is speaking to that rather directly, it seems. Monday, he made a very strong set of remarks in the course of a press conference, Gordon Chang, I'm sure you caught it, in which he said, quote, "We should never be reliant on a foreign country for the means of our own survival." I think he was speaking specifically of the practice of supply chains running from China to the United States for medicines, among other things. And he talked about, you know, the need to bring back our manufacturing jobs. He talked about the imperative of securing our borders. He said, "Now both parties must unite to ensure America is truly an independent nation in every sense of the word." It felt to me as though he was sort of channeling Gordon Chang on a lot of those points. As a matter of fact, you've been making these arguments about decoupling or disengaging from China for years, Gordon. I think to your great credit, it's been absolutely sound advice, but it's got a resonance today. I don't think there's any doubt about it, not just with the president, but with the public in this country in the wake of this pandemic. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I can't take credit for this. I mean, there are a lot of people who have been talking about disengagement. But clearly, this is now the dominant narrative, not only in the administration, but in the United States as well. And the Chinese are going to drive this. It's not something that we want, of course, but it's something that we've been talking about delinking because of what we have seen. And that is China, through its actions, have undermined the United States, have attacked us, have criticized us, have really shaken our society. And so, you know, we didn't see that it was an epidemic that was going to do this, but nonetheless, it was inevitable from what China was doing that in some way it was going to harm us in ways that we feel that we can't go back. So the president's comments on Monday were absolutely 100% on target. And I think Americans will eventually rally behind that, especially if he does win a second term. This is going to be the policies of the administration.
Well, I very much hope, as you know, that the work of our Committee on the Present Danger of China has been very much focused on this, that the president or whoever is the next commander-in-chief have a mandate to do just that. And I think that's what's coming as a result of the hard experience, the mugging by reality, as I've said in a commentary today, that all of us have experienced as a result of the pandemic. You may not want all of the credit. You will doubtless not get all of it, but you certainly deserve a great deal of it for helping us think these things through, Gordon Chang. You do it here each week, for which we are very grateful. Those who follow you at Gordon G. Chang benefit from you and your insights between times, and I hope that you will keep up the great work, my friend, and stay safe. We'll talk with you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore of Texas these days about this problem of social engineering and the possibility that it might eventuate in conflict with China. That and much more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say I'm joined by a longtime friend and colleague dating back, well, a lifetime ago to our service in the Reagan Defense Department. His name is Chuck DeVore. He was at the time a White House appointee in the Pentagon with the title of Special Assistant for Foreign Affairs. He and I have remained in touch over the years as he has undertaken a number of impressive feats of service in both the private sector, in the aerospace industry, and in public service in California, where he lived for many years, including time in the assembly there as a legislator, and now as a very senior member of and influential voice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation in the role of the Vice President for National Initiatives. He is, among other things, a man who rose to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army Reserve. He's now retired from it, having served in the National Guard for some 14 years as an intelligence officer. A man, in short, of many parts and a great resource, among other things, on what we face at the moment from the Chinese Communist Party. Chuck DeVore, it's good to have you back. Welcome. I've been talking with Sasha Gong and Gordon Chang in the course of the program about a proposition that I wanted to put to you, too, particularly with your military background and your specialization in intelligence, Chuck, and that is we're watching, of course, the Chinese using very aggressively propaganda against the United States. And the obvious purpose of that is to sort of shift the blame and to perhaps induce our own elites and media and those of foreign governments, including allied ones, to think less of this country and to sort of help promote the idea that China is, well, a cure for the coronavirus, is the way I think of it, as well as, you know, a coming force in the international arena. There's another possible explanation for what they're up to and why they're doing it so aggressively, and I wanted just to get your thoughts on it. And that is that this may be a case of what's known as social engineering, trying to arouse the Chinese people against the United States in a very aggressive way, perhaps in support of other kinds of aggression, the old-fashioned kind included. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is a very troubling development when you have China's foreign ministry spokesman, Zhao Lijian, suggesting not that long ago that the U.S. Army was responsible for the virus when it sent a delegation to Wuhan during the World Military Games last October. And that's troublesome because if you claim that your main rival's army brought the virus over on purpose, that's a casus belli. That's an excuse for war right there.
It is indeed. And that's the thing that I guess I'm most interested in talking through with you, Chuck. As an intelligence veteran, indicators and warnings are the sorts of things that, of course, people in your business use to try to assure that we're not surprised by what an adversary might do. What would you be looking for vis-a-vis China if it were preparing for some kind of act of military aggression? And are you seeing any of those indicators now?
Well, there's a few things that I'd look at, and mind you, these are things that we can see in open source because I certainly don't have access to classified information anymore. But one of the things I'm seeing is a call for overseas Chinese to return back to the motherland, to fly back to the People's Republic of China. And you are seeing quite a bit of this. In fact, Chinese propaganda has been emphasizing that all of the new cases of the coronavirus that originated in Wuhan, China, are imported. In other words, they're from Chinese who are returning back to mainland China. And so why is this important? Well, if something bad happens, you don't want hundreds of thousands of your citizens to be trapped overseas, potentially in some nations that you might be in active conflict with. So that's one rather troubling thing to see. The other is there seems to be an escalating series of provocations, especially in the Taiwan Strait. You're seeing this with the People's Liberation Army Air Force, and you're seeing this with the People's Liberation Army Navy. Both are ramping up some pretty significant provocations against Taiwan. You're also seeing that with some maritime militia. There was a disturbing incident last week where there was some illegal fishing activity going on in just off an island controlled by Taiwan. And when the Taiwanese Coast Guard went out to take care of this illegal fishing activity, they were attacked by, I think it was 10 speedboats, some of which rammed the Taiwanese vessels, causing some significant damage.
Now, these were illegal fishing vessels of China and speedboats from China, even though I think they were unmarked. But again, does seem to be a very hostile act. In fact, damaged, I believe, the cutter's engines and had to be repaired at some expense. Japan is also being visited by Chinese air forces, as I understand it, including inside their air defense identification zone. Is that out of the norm and worrying as well?
Well, right. I mean, because what you're seeing in this case is some disputed air defense area. I mean, this is a region that both the U.S. and Japan have acknowledged is Japan's airspace and its responsibility. And China has unilaterally decided, no, this is our airspace. And so you're beginning to see the salami tactics in being employed by the People's Republic of China against its neighbors. The key is, what do you do about it? And I guess the challenge is right now that the Chinese leadership may believe that the Western democracies are very much focused on trying to get a handle on this new virus that is wrecking havoc on their economies, and may see an opportunity to perhaps engage in some adventurism when other people are busy.
And perhaps in a less robust posture, readiness posture. This is something I heard Secretary Mark Esper talking about, the defense secretary, this morning, assuring the audience of a radio show that that wasn't the case. But I have the feeling that the Chinese may think otherwise. I caught a report the other day, Chuck, I think you may have seen as well, that it's very quiet in Pearl Harbor at the moment, a sign of sort of the care that is being exercised by the United States military to do some social distancing and that sort of thing. And it's a question of whether or not the Chinese perceive all of this as an opportunity to act. Let me ask you about something else, Chuck, if I could. Speaking of your intelligence background, we've been hearing a lot lately about something called the Thousand Talents Program in the United States. This is a little different from all of the other activities that the Chinese have been engaging in to steal intellectual property and otherwise collect intelligence in our country. But the FBI is calling it a non-traditional form of espionage. What can you tell us about it, and should we be concerned about it?
Well, this is a very concerning development. It's been going on for a while. It was established in 2008. And originally, it focused on individuals who were either Chinese nationals or recent immigrants, people who had relatives in China, who were engaged in top-level research, basic research often, most of it paid for by U.S. taxpayer dollars. And the goal was basically, hey, you know, you owe it to your motherland to bring back this valuable information and help make your country, your motherland, rich and powerful. And much of it, of course, was done under the guise of of academic exchange. You know, and you have many academics from all over the world that believe that this sort of information needs to be shared, and that there really is no such thing as proprietary information when it comes to science. And so they kind of play upon these notions. But what we're beginning to see now is larger numbers of Americans participating in this program, including individuals that have no connection from a heritage standpoint with mainland China. You're beginning to see scientists in very important fields like nanotechnology, as we saw with the professor from Harvard, basically give away enormously valuable information to China in exchange, in this case, for several hundreds of thousands of dollars of augmented pay that the professor never reported to authorities.
Including the Defense Department, with whom he was also working, which got him into a bit of a crack. I think it was something like $50,000 a month he was pulling down. That's a lot of augmentation of pay. Chuck, I know you left California a long time ago, but one of the people who has been associated with this program, I just wanted to get your thoughts about it, him and his role, is the Chief Investment Officer of the California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS. His name is Yu-Ben Meng. On his watch in that role, having come back from managing China's $3 trillion foreign exchange reserves, he has more than trebled the number of Chinese companies that CalPERS is invested in. Worrying, I think, on several different counts. Do you agree?
Well, absolutely. And the challenge here is manifold. First of all, this is the biggest pension fund in the world, right? This is the biggest government pension fund in the world. Number two, the individual you mentioned boasted how he was now in a position to help the motherland, to help China. It just openly boasted about it. And while a lot of these investments, he and his defenders have claimed, well, these are just part of index funds, and this is just part of prudent diversification of the investment pools, the challenge with that is that we're dealing with government money, with taxpayer money that is owed to the government employees in California. And any shortfall of that fund has to be made up by the taxpayers of the state of California. And furthermore, what we're doing with this money is we're enriching a nation that has as its object becoming the world's most powerful nation, both economically and militarily, and openly talks about threatening the United States and our values. So I just think that is very unwise.
Well, and especially insofar as some of that money is going into companies that are actually at the leading edge of giving the Chinese the capability to threaten our men and women in uniform and the rest of us for that matter. Chuck DeVore, these are the reasons that we value so much your contributions to our program. I hope you will come back to us again very soon. This is vital work. The indicators and warnings are troubling, and we need people like you to help us make sense of them. So keep up the good work at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and do visit with us again very soon. Next up, David Goldman. We'll talk with him about what's going on in the financial sector and what it might mean for you with all this pandemic business right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with David Goldman, one of the smartest guys I know on, well, just about everything. He is, of course, a contributor to Asia Times under the byline Spengler. He is the author of How Civilizations Die. David Goldman, it's good to have you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Let me ask you first and foremost about something that's directly in your wheelhouse, and that is kind of your assessment of the financial markets of the United States, the toll that has been taken on them so far by the pandemic, and what your assessments are of the prospects of it recovering anytime soon.
Well, we have a real shock to the system. You saw that in the millions of new unemployment applications that were announced this morning. We certainly will have a steep recession in the second quarter. It's inevitable if you make people stay home and not work. This real shock has uncovered some longstanding weaknesses in the financial system, namely the application of a great deal of leverage to fairly slim profit margins. A great example is real estate, where office buildings in New York City or San Francisco are offering a rate of return of about 2.5%. That's, you know, the rental income divided by the price of the building. And when you borrow a lot of money to lever up those cash flows in order to show a high rate of return, it looks good for a while. But if suddenly people are not willing to extend leverage because balance sheets are under strain, then you get a real problem. That's why we had real estate investment trusts, which were supposed to be a fairly safe and conservative investment, absolutely crash. And of course, they bounced after the Federal Reserve announced that it had an unlimited budget for bailing out weaker sectors of the economy. Still, I don't think that the more levered sectors of the economy are going to do very well. Another part of the problem is that because we have a big balance of payments deficit, still about 4% of GDP, we're very dependent on foreigners who taking the proceeds of the goods they sell us and reinvesting it back into U.S. capital markets. And that entire process has been disrupted by the strain on bank balance sheets, the inability to find foreign exchange hedges. So the Federal Reserve has actually been pumping vast amounts of money, hundreds of billions of dollars, into international banks in order to stabilize them so they won't be in a position of forced liquidation of American securities, because that's disrupting our markets. So the bottom line is, I think the situation's still shaky. I think it's a good time to buy defensive stocks, which have strong cash flows, strong market share, less economic exposure. I'm talking about consumer staples companies, the Coke and Pepsi's and Procter's and Gamble's, and the stronger utilities. Utilities were unfairly punished by the overall market crash, and I think still represent a bargain. I've been buyers in both sectors. But essentially, I think the criteria should be companies with strong market share, strong balance sheets. Some of the larger tech companies have obviously done better, but not sort of general buying, and certainly caution about anything with a great deal of leverage attached to it.
As a financial guy, David Goldman, how do you regard the idea of the Fed having essentially unlimited power to print money, I guess, to the tune of $4 trillion is what we've been told coming out of this Senate legislation?
Well, it's very frightening, Frank. We've had swings of 1% within days in so-called real interest rates. That's measured by the yield on Treasury inflation-protected securities. And the market's been telling us that we don't have unlimited toleration to push up the budget deficit and the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. We were running a budget deficit of, about 4% of GDP, $1 trillion, before this happened. Now, it'll probably go up to perhaps 20% of GDP, at least temporarily, with $2 trillion of spending and perhaps $1 trillion of lost tax revenue. So $4 trillion deficit's very scary. I think we can get through this crisis because everyone knows we have no choice but to do this in the short term. But if we don't start repairing our enormous exposure to off-balance sheet liabilities for entitlements, if we don't start improving our current account deficit, if we don't reduce the deficit in the future, at some point the credit of the United States will be impaired, and then we'll really be in trouble. And so I think we've got one more shock, but the markets really told us we have to start repairing the roof when it stops raining.
David, we've had others on the show discuss their concerns about this being a moment in which a serious, re-look at international willingness to use the dollar as the reserve currency of the world is likely to be intensifying. Do you see it that way?
The problem is when there will be an alternative. The Chinese have the largest financial market next to ours, but they are very far away from being able to provide a reserve currency because they still have capital controls. People won't hold their reserves, their current account balances in a currency, or they can't trade it freely, and they can't buy a variety of assets. So the Chinese will take a long time to reform this, if ever they do. So we have a free pass simply because of the lack of the alternative. But at a 5 or 10 year horizon, we can't count on that happening forever.
In the meantime, I've been hearing people say, well, the Chinese, the Russians, and perhaps Europeans and others are going to pull in behind some sort of international monetary fund, digitalized currency as a means of weaning us all off the dollar. Obviously, very bad for the U.S. under the circumstances that you've just described. Does that sound to you as though that's a realistic alternative?
In the long term, it is, provided China succeeds in financial market reforms, which is something they promised for years and haven't made very much progress. I don't think it's a short-term threat. It's not a 2 or 3 year horizon threat. If we continue to run gigantic budget deficits, balloon the Fed's balance sheet, and run big current account deficits, and eventually, it is a serious threat. But as I said, it's a 5 to 10 year horizon thing. It's not something that we have to spend nights worrying about now.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, let's see. David, lastly, there is, of course, another factor in this economic turmoil, and that is the war that has been unleashed ostensibly between the Russians and the Saudis over oil prices. The intended target for many of us seems to be the American fracking industry and energy sector more generally. Tell us how you see that playing into the turmoil, the challenges that you've described, and the appointment of an old friend, Victoria Coates, to help negotiate matters with the Saudis in this regard.
Well, the Saudis have not been particularly friendly to us in this. This is lifeblood economics. Oil demand recedes. Saudi Arabia and Russia are all fighting for market share. The U.S. has gained enormous market share because of the explosion of shale production. So effectively, the Russians and Chinese, which have much lower drilling costs, onshore drilling costs in Russia are about $18 a barrel. They're even considerably less than that in Saudi Arabia, decided to flood the market with oil, crash the oil price. We're down to $23 a barrel, which wipes out the shale producers who basically need a price minimum in the 40s to stay in business. The idea being once there is, once the U.S. is vastly reduced in its capacity for oil production, the Saudis and Russians will then fight for market share between themselves. So I think the point of leverage we have is on the Saudis, who depend on us really for their existence. I'm very pleased that Victoria Coates is one of the most competent and experienced public officials that we have, has been made special energy envoy to Saudi Arabia. President Trump promised last week that he'd get involved in this, and he's followed through by sending Ms. Coates to talk to the Saudis. And I think we need to read them the riot act.
Let's hope she'll do it. She's capable of it, that's for sure. David Goldman, thank you for this quick tour de raison of your portfolios and your insights into how you're investing them at the moment. We appreciate your time as always. And Godspeed, my friend. Stay well. We appreciate everybody else's time, the chance to talk with you. We look forward to doing so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.